Good evening and welcome to Behind the News for April 1st, 2004. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the world's of economics and politics. And two interviews scheduled tonight, this being April Fool's Day, I should say. I got a special exclusive interview with Madonna, but I really don't. The first segment is a return interview with Robert Fatten, who is a professor of politics at the University of Virginia and author of a book called Haiti's Predatory Republic. And we'll talk to him about Haiti's class structure, the underlying social and political structures of Haiti, and the coming and going again of Jean-Bertrand Aristide. And then at the bottom of the hour, just slightly after, we'll speak an interview recorded yesterday with Carlos Mejia, who deserted from his unit in Iraq and is now facing court-martial. He is in Florida, back with his unit, but will be facing trial, I believe, next month. And we'll talk to him about what he saw in Iraq and what he's experiencing now and what he's looking forward to. That in about half an hour. A couple of announcements. First, a couple of talks at or panels, rather, sponsored by the Union for Radical Political Economics, URPE, at the Brecht Forum. Brecht Forum for a little while longer, 122 West 27th Street in Manhattan, 10th floor, between 6th and 7th Avenues. And on April 14th, 6 days from tonight, 13 days from tonight, a program called Lights Out, Privatization and the Deregulation of Electricity. Long Island energy activist Gordian Raki, former investment banker turned journalist Nomi Prinz, economist Rini Tobak, will all talk about Wall Street, privatization, and the markets in electricity. That's Wednesday, April 14th at the Brecht Forum at 7:30 p.m. And then a week later, Wednesday, April 21st, the changing structure of capitalism, job losses, and class struggles. The speakers there will be Bharavai Desai of the Taxi Workers Alliance, which won what looks like a victory for the taxi workers the other day with a fare increase, but a limited increase in payments to the leaseholders. So good work on the behalf of the New York Taxi Workers Alliance. Joan Hoffman, professor of economics at John Jay College. Ali Mir, who teaches information systems at William Patterson University, and Rick Wolf, economics professor at UMass Amherst. They'll all talk about the job losses, class struggles, and the changing structure of capitalism today. That's at the Brecht Forum, April 21st, 122 West 27th Street, 7:30 p.m. And a couple of words in the economic headlines. Keep it short because I want to have a long chat with Robert Fatten, whose book, Haiti's Predatory Republic, is really quite an excellent piece of work. His publisher failed to get me in time before the last interview, but I've been reading it since, and very clarifying, intelligent piece of work. It was reported this morning that first-time claims for unemployment benefits, the initial claims, a very sensitive indicator of what's happening in the job market in the United States, that fell by 3,000 last week. And it's a four-week moving average stayed unchanged at about 340,000. This indicator has more or less stabilized over the last several weeks, but it began a long downtrend about a year ago and is showing signs of a somewhat strengthening labor market. Not mighty, though, because it seems that a lot of people are also just falling off the jobless rolls and not finding new work. That is, they're exhausting their benefits. They're running their full 26-week period, and so they're not able to continue drawing after that period. So it does seem that while the pace of layoffs has slowed, the pace of hiring has yet to pick up. We'll hear more about this tomorrow when the job numbers for March will be released by the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics tomorrow morning at 8:30, expecting modest gains in jobs at about 100,000 or so. No change in the unemployment rate. So these are mildly positive numbers. Not a very strong labor market, a little better than we saw last year, but still nothing great. And a lot of lost jobs to be made up. We're about 8 million jobs below where we should be at this point in an economic expansion. So things are not doing great, a little better, but still a long ways to go. The Institute for Supply Management, which is a trade association for purchasing managers, who are people who buy things for corporations and are very aware of the state of business. The Institute for Supply Management polls purchasing managers at manufacturing firms and also at service firms. The manufacturing index was released this morning. Was up at 62.5. Any number above 50 signifies an expanding manufacturing sector. Any number below 50, a contracting manufacturing sector. And so 62.5 is a pretty strong reading. It also shows a pickup in the employment index, which is at 57, which is the highest it's been in many, many months, many years, rather. It's also portending expansion in factory employment, which has declined for something like 42 consecutive months, has yet to turn around. The ISM employment index has been signaling an expanding factory workforce for several months now, but the actual job numbers have refused to comply with this indication. So we'll see tomorrow morning if they actually finally begin to catch up. Reuters, the wire service, does a similar poll of purchasing managers in Europe. It was reported today as well, that their number is at 53.5, an improvement from the previous months, but very weak unemployment number, still below 50. So it seems that while there's some degree of recovery apparent in European manufacturing, also there doesn't seem to be any kind of recovery in manufacturing employment in Europe. And the unemployment rate for the Eurozone, that is the 12 countries in the who use the euro as their currency in Western Europe, remained steady at 8.8%, where it's been now for, 12 consecutive months. They have a chart here I'm reading from of the Eurozone unemployment rate, and I've never seen anything like it, just a complete flat line at 8.8%. You don't see that in too many economic series, but there it is. So while it seems that we're seeing a headline recovery in some of the European economic numbers, that is yet to trickle down to the labor market. So this is a interesting thing around the world. Japan showing signs of economic recovery, but no signs of that in the job market there. We're seeing that in Mexico. We're seeing that in the United States, and we're seeing that in Western Europe. So it seems worldwide we're getting weak economic recoveries, but those recoveries are not yet reaching down to the people. And are we having trouble getting Robert Fatten on the phone?
Our phone codes are changing. I think that's the problem.
All right. Well, let's switch our segments around, and let's do the interview with our Carlos Mejia first. And Carlos Mejia, who is was with the Florida National Guard stationed in Iraq, left Iraq in October for a little R&R and decided not to return. And he was in hiding for a couple of months, but then a few weeks ago surrendered to the authorities and now faces court-martial for desertion. And there's a good story about him on the Nation magazine's website. For some reason, the Nation couldn't find any space for it in their magazine, but they did put it up on their website. Deserter Speaks by Christian Parenti, who's been on this show several times talking about his visits to Iraq, and that's where he met Carlos Mejia. And you can find it in the Nation's website, thenation.com. Look for A Deserter Speaks by Christian Parenti. So let's listen to A Deserter Speaking to Me, interview recorded yesterday. Tell us where you are right now.
Right now I'm at Fort Stewart, Georgia. It's a base, an active duty base, which is where my unit deployed from before we went to the Middle East.
And what fate awaits you? Do you have any idea yet?
Yeah, actually, we have an arraignment hearing for the 10th, actually the 16th of April, and then on the 10th of May, my court-martial begins. And I'm facing the charges of desertion with the intent to avoid hazardous duty with a penalty of 1 year confinement and a bad conduct discharge.
Tell us how you decided to leave the Army, or to leave Iraq.
Well, because I'm facing criminal charges right now, my attorney advised me not to really speak about that. But one clarification I want to make is that I never really decided to leave the Army. What I can tell you is that I did not feel safe. I did not feel that I could, you know, go back and be tried fairly, you know. So I decided to go and seek, civilian counsel. But my intention was always to go back, you know, to the military and face my responsibility and go to court. You know, I've never been afraid of a fair trial.
Tell us what you saw there, and I understand you underwent some kind of process of disillusionment.
It wasn't really a process of disillusionment. I was never really illusioned about the war to begin with. What I saw there is that you cannot really accomplish anything with violence. You know, you're there, and you know, you get into firefights and stuff like that, and it's not that the people who are attacking us are, they don't care about their own people, that we don't care about the Iraqi people, but, you know, unfortunately, in firefights, you know, the people who really die, you know, are the civilians, you know, the unarmed civilians. You know, it happened many times, and it's not that I want, you know, soldiers to die or that I want the people who attack us to die, but, you know, who is really paying for this, you know, war, you know, and these firefights, who is dying, you know, people who are unarmed, you know, the only thing that you really accomplish with violence is more violence. And the other thing is that, you know, I don't really think that this war is about terrorism, you know, I don't think it's about, you know, bringing democracy into Iraq, you know, I think that this war is about oil, and I don't want to be a part of it.
Well, why do you think that?
Why do I think that this war is about oil?
Yes.
Well, I think it's pretty obvious. The weapons of mass destruction were never found. You know, you have experts saying that there are no weapons of mass destruction, probably have not been weapons of mass destruction since 91. And the link between Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda was never proven. You know, all the reasons they gave us to go to war, you know, have turned out to be, you know, lies, you know, or at least, you know, they have not been able to, you know, bring any evidence. And at the same time, you see that all these corporations are taking over Iraq, you know, pretty much privatizing the whole country and buying all the infrastructure and, you know, just making all the profits. So it's pretty clear that it's an oil-driven war.
Well, tell us about what you did. What was your, where were you stationed? What were you, what were your days like when you were on duty?
Well, I'm an infantryman, and I was a squad leader, and the majority of the time that I spent in Iraq, it was in a place called Al-Ramadi, which is northwest of Baghdad, and about 30 or 60 kilometers northwest of Baghdad. And it's a Sunni triangle city, and there was a lot of support there for Saddam Hussein. He had two palaces there, and, you know, you could see the development in that city because it was a Sunni city. And we did raids, we did traffic control points, we did handle some detainees. Basically just, you know, combat missions, you know. We were out there, you know, we did the patrols and everything. So, it's, you know, pretty infantry work, you know, in urban terrain.
And what sense did you get from the Iraqis that you saw? How did they feel about your presence?
Well, when we first got to the city, it was, you know, they were pretty friendly. But that was towards mid-May, 18th, 19th of May, when I first arrived in Ramadi. And they were pretty friendly in the beginning, but then, you know, in time, as you get to know the people, you know, because you get these different missions, you know, where you have to go guard a hospital or you have to go guard a propane station or a gas station, and you get to interact with the people, you know, on a regular basis, you know, every week, every other week, and people just start wondering, you know, what's going on, you know, why is it that you guys are still here? And then there's no electricity, and then there's no, you know, no work, no gas, you know. On top of that, you have firefights, and you have the raids, and you have, you know, an occupation, you know. So attitudes change, you know, especially when you have the people die, you know, in firefights, you know, which is not really our fault. You know, I have to honestly say that, you know, every time that we fired at someone, we were fired upon. But that's besides the point, you know. The fact is that, you know, people are dying. You know, situation was not improving, and it got to a point where they didn't really want us there anymore. You know, and we didn't really want to be there anymore. You could feel the change in the attitude of the people. You know.
And how did your fellow soldiers or your comrades feel about what they were doing there and what you did?
I can tell you that their morale was pretty low. As far as political conversations and stuff like that, we didn't really have many. Soldiers don't really talk about these issues, you know. I mean, we're taught to just simply obey orders and, you know, not question the authority and you know, everything that they tell you to do, you just do. So you cannot expect, you know, a whole lot of, you know, political debate, you know, especially in an infantry unit, you know. So they weren't really saying much. I mean, there were people in my unit that were talking and that were just wondering, you know, why is it that, you know, we haven't found weapons of mass destruction and we're still here? But it wasn't very often, you know, questions like that, never really deep conversations or anything like that, you know. But you could see, you know, we're questioning, dealing more with the environment, you know, with what's going on, you know, why is it that we're here for so long, you know, where is the reconstruction, and, you know, what are we supposed to be doing here, you know. You're there 1 month, 2 months, 3 months, and you don't see any reconstruction going on, you know, people are beginning to hate you. You just lose purpose, you know. You just lose purpose.
And have you been in contact with any of your colleagues there?
Yeah, here at Fort Stewart, a lot of the people who went to Iraq with me are here on medical hold. People who have all type of, you know, physical problems now. You know, people who have difficulty hearing. You know, people who have knee problems. People who have shoulder problems. So I've been, you know, communicating on a regular basis with people from my unit, and they support me. You know, they're 100% with me. You know, when it's time to go to trial, you know, they'll testify for me if they have to. So I'm getting, at least from the people who are here, I'm getting a lot of support.
The official casualty rates are seem rather low, but you know, you just mentioned that there are quite a few people who've been returned to the U.S. because of some kind of physical damage or other. Are people suffering much more than the headline numbers would lead us to believe?
I think the headline numbers, they concentrate on people who are killed. But the other face to that is the people who are injured, you know, and you also have people who get sick. You have the people who, you know, come back with mental problems, you know, combat stress, you know, post-traumatic stress disorder, depression. So I don't think that the media has portrayed the real face of, you know, what is really going on with the soldiers, you know. I mean, one thing is to say, okay, one soldier died this week, you know, but how many got injured, you know, how many got wounded, you know, how many of them lost limbs, you know, how many of them will need a wheelchair, you know, how many of them will lose an arm. So I don't think that the media is concentrating on that, you know. I think that the pain and the suffering of the soldiers has been kept secret, you know. I think that, you know, to simply speak about the deaths is misleading.
I'm speaking with Camilo Mejia, who left his National Guard unit in Iraq in October, not to return, and now faces court-martial for desertion.
You said in the past that the commanding officers would send soldiers on patrols over the same route, exposing them to danger in order to draw some casualties and make themselves look heroic. Is that true? Is that the kind of thing that goes on regularly?
Well, can I tell you that it's true because it's just a matter of perception. I believe it's true. It's my opinion that a lot of times, you know, we did things in ways that went completely against everything we have been taught in the infantry, you know, things as basic as, you know, changing your routines, you know, not staying in one place for too long, you know, not leaving a pattern behind you. Just basic things that we should not have done, or, you know, basic rules that we should have followed were not followed. And the only answer that I can find for that is, you know, that they were very interested in, you know, getting their combat experience and getting their Purple Hearts or combat infantry badges and stuff like that. That's the only answer that I find. I cannot say 100% for sure that that's the only motivation that they had, but in my opinion, certainly that was one of the biggest motivations that some commanders had, you know, for sending troops out on missions, you know, that to me were senseless.
And did the officers themselves go out on patrols, or is that just for the grunts to handle?
Well, our officers are grunt officers, but it depends, really, because if you have a squad-level mission, you know, the highest-ranking person that'll go there is a squad leader. You know, sometimes, you know, the platoon leader will tag along, but it's not a mission for, a company commander. If a whole company goes on a mission, then the company commander goes there. If it's a battalion-level mission, then the battalion commander will be there. But that's the way it works, you know. I mean, you cannot expect to see a battalion commander, you know, in a platoon mission, for instance. You know, the highest ranking person that should be there really is the platoon leader.
Now, I've also heard some complaints about like day to day life. The food stinks. The accommodations stink. What was that like for you?
Well, I can really complain about that because I'm an infantryman. You know, infantrymen are taught to live in rough conditions. You know, we're taught to, you know, sleep on the ground and eat whatever there is to eat. But I do have some questions about, you know, how they're saying that they're supporting the troops and that the war is costing $1 billion a week. And, you know, at the same time, we had serious shortages. You know, like, we didn't get our vests until June, you know, our bulletproof vests. And we were deployed in March, you know, so that's quite a few months, you know, being without a vest. You know, basic clothing allowance, you know, or the basic clothing issue, you know. We didn't have, you know, the uniforms that we were supposed to have. Ammunition, you know, you're getting to some serious stuff, you know, because we only went with a basic load of ammunition. And when I went on R&R in October, we had not been resupplied with ammo. And the same applies to night vision equipment, the same applies to tires for vehicles, the same applies to losing people, you know, due to injuries and disease. You know, we don't get replacements. So the platoons and the companies begin to shrink. You know, you start losing vehicles, you start losing ammunition, and you don't get resupplied. So, you know, where's the money going? You know, it's not a matter of, you know, whether I'm comfortable or not. You know, it's a matter of, you know, what's going on with the money. You know, are they really supporting the troops? I believe that's the question, the more important question.
Now, are you with the National Guard?
Yes, the Florida National Guard.
And how do you have any sense of how well you're supplied compared to, say, what the 82nd Airborne got? Is there some sort of a hierarchy of these things?
You know, I cannot tell you for sure, but just a hunch, I think that they were better supplied. Because I never heard from anybody from active duty complaining about not having enough ammunition or having shortages on vehicles. And, you know, they keep getting people, you know, whenever somebody gets injured, you know, it might take a while, but they usually get somebody else. And to my knowledge, we never got any, you know, replacements, you know, as far as people or ammunition. So I think that there is a difference. You know, I think that active duty units are a lot more independent. You know, when you deploy, you know, with an infantry National Guard unit, you know, you're usually dependent on the active duty component, and we depend on them for supplies. And that becomes a pain, you know, because you know, where are the supplies? You know, how do you get resupplied? When do you get resupplied? And you need that stuff. You know, you're out there getting in firefights. You need your ammunition. You need your vests. You need your vehicles. You need your people.
And when you signed up, did you have any sense that you would see combat, or was that far from your mind at the time?
No, actually, I signed up for infantry, so I did have a sense that there would be combat. I just didn't think that it would be for oil, you know. When you sign up, especially for infantry, but I think anybody in the military who signs up has to realize that the possibility of war is real. But what type of war are we talking about, you know? Recruiters don't tell you that you're going to go to a war for oil, you know. They don't tell you that, you know, the government is going to lie to the people and to the world, you know, and come up with whatever justification they can find, you know, in order to invade a country to, you know, take their oil. You know, that's just not what you sign for.
What kind of ideological or political indoctrination do you get? Do the commanders tell you why you're going off to war, or is there some sort of a pep talk that you get before you go?
The only political indoctrination that you get is to not question your superiors, you know, that you're a soldier and, you know, whatever they tell you to do, that's what you should do. And I believe that's wrong. I believe that, you know, before you're a soldier, you're a human being, and you have a sense of right or wrong, and you should always follow your conscience. You know, you should always ask questions. You know, is this right? You know, it's what we're doing really justified? Do we have a right to be here? Whether you're wearing a uniform or not, you know, you're gonna have to live with yourself, you know, after you get out of the army. And if you don't have justifications for the things that you do, you know, saying that you signed a contract is not gonna cut it.
So how did you decide that you're going to turn yourself in? Did you ever contemplate just trying to stay underground, or did you plan to turn yourself in all along?
No, I never contemplated staying underground, because the underground life is, first of all, the underground life is, to me, it's not an option, because honestly, I don't think I committed a crime, you know, so why should I sacrifice my freedom, you know, for a crime I did not commit? You know, that's one thing. And then the other thing is that I always wanted to face my responsibility with the military. I just did not feel ready. I just did not feel that I could be tried fairly. So I never really decided that, you know, I never even thought that I would not turn myself in back to the military. You know, I just wanted to make sure that I was ready and that, you know, conditions were favorable.
Do you have any sense of if other people are have done the same thing or are planning to do the same thing?
Only what people know, what the news say. You know, I heard that two other soldiers applied for CO status in Iraq. I know about Jeremy Hintzman, who's in Canada. I know about Stephen Funk, who's a Marine, also a conscientious objector, who recently got out of jail. But I don't really know about any more, you know, like underground GIs who are deserters or conscientious objectors. I don't really know. If there are many, or just a few, I don't really know. I guess I'll have to go, you know, by what the military says. You know, I think something like 600 or something like that, but I'm not in touch with them.
And, I mean, how do you feel about the trial coming up? Are you optimistic, or do you think you know, the military justice system will have its way and you're going to have to steer serve some time?
So far, I've been treated very fairly here. They've treated me with lots of respect. And if things continue to be that way, I don't have a problem with the trial, you know. I mean, I've always, you know, wanted to be tried, you know. And if things continue to be fair, then, you know, I have no fear, you know. And I do feel very optimistic about it, you know. I have some good arguments, you know. I have people behind me, the people even from my own unit. All of the ones who are here are behind me 100%. They will testify for me. So I think I have a pretty strong case, and I'm not afraid, you know, I'm ready.
Anything our listeners might be able to do on your behalf?
The listeners that might be able to be on my behalf? I mean, I don't know, I don't think that on my behalf, but on the behalf of the people who are in Iraq, you know, I think that this war, it's illegal and it's immoral and it's criminal, and I think that people should really pay more attention to that. You know, this issue is so much bigger than myself, than just one man, than one soldier. There were soldiers in Iraq who signed to fight for freedom and to fight for other ideals, and yet there they are, you know, dying for oil. And I think that people should come together and make a stand, you know, to put an end to this war.
Well, thank you, and I admire your courage in doing what you've done. Thanks.
Thank you for allowing me to speak in your program.
And that was Carlos Mejia, who left his unit in Iraq last year and will be facing a court-martial soon for desertion, explaining his reasons for what he did and how he feels about facing a court-martial. This is Doug Henwood, the program Behind the News, and we'll be back with Robert Fathom after this word from Charles Ives. And that excerpt from Charles Ives' The Unanswered Question, performed by the Cleveland Orchestra under Christoph von Donyahy. And this is Doug Henwood, the program Behind the News, WBAI, New York 99.5 FM, and on the web at WBAI.org. And now we're joined on the line, finally, after some telephonic melodrama by Robert Fatton, who is the author of Haiti's Predatory Republic, The Unending Transition to Democracy, professor of political science at the University of Virginia, a place where I spent 3 years long ago. Welcome to WBAI.
Good afternoon.
Thanks for joining us, and our apologies for the phone mix-up, but we're finally on top of these matters with improvised solutions. And I wanted to we talked a lot about the history of Haiti last time. I wanted to talk some about some of the material you cover in the book, about the class structure of Haiti, and then some also about where Aristide came from, where the forces against him came from, and what you think is going on now. So let's start by you describe an interesting class structure in that the Haiti, a very poor country, doesn't have what we'd think of as a classic bourgeoisie. It's got a relatively small one, and then another class that sort of runs the state, and that's the source of its wealth and power. But could you talk a bit about this sort of the different factions of the Haitian elite?
Yes, I mean, when you look at the Haitian state, at least since the period of the Duvalier dictatorship, what you had was an emerging black bourgeoisie which captured the state, as it were, in order to enrich itself. On the other hand, there was what I have called the possessing class, and that was the class that has traditionally been associated to the mulatto elite. In other words, those who have always had, since the beginning of the country, privileged access to wealth and to land. And that class, for a long time, till probably about Duvalier, controlled the political system by essentially dominating those who were in power. And if that failed, then there was always the military that could, in fact, play the role of an institution that would protect, if you wish, the privileges of that elite. What happened with Duvalier is that you had the emergence of what at the time was a black middle class, which lacked economic power and which lacked political power. So when Duvalier captured power, he controlled the state and he created, to some extent, a black upper class. And what happened by the time his son, Jean-Claude Duvalier, was president was, to some extent, a fusion between the old mulatto classes and the more recent ruling class that acquired power and privilege through the state. And that was symbolized by the marriage of Jean-Claude Duvalier to Michel Bennet, and Michel Bennet was a member of the traditional mulatto elite. So there was kind of a fusion, although many members in the old Duvalierist regime did not like that fusion at all. But this is a recurring theme, because when you see the ascendancy of Aristide, especially in the last 4 years, what you had was a similar metamorphosis of lower middle class into a group that acquired political power, initially to really transform society, but ultimately which kept power and used that power to accumulate wealth. And this is why you had a significant amount of corruption, and that the state is has been virtually bankrupt for the last 50 years or so.
Now, the military, is that sort of an independent center of power, or is it really operate under the orders of some significant class fraction?
Well, the military has its own institutional interests, but on the other hand, those interests tend to coincide with the interests of the privileged groups in Haiti. So when you look, for instance, at the coup of 1991 that overthrew Aristide, it's very clear that the military had significant grievances against Aristide, because Aristide had attacked the military, in particular the officer corps. And on the other hand, the military were also not surprisingly, allied to the traditional privileged classes of Haiti, and to some extent, a significant amount of money was given to the military in order to wage the coup by that privilege, by those privileged groups. And then you obviously have the external factors. The military have traditionally been trained by the United States, and to some extent have been used when the United States felt that it needed them to reestablish some sort of order, at least order that the United States perceived as being in its national interest.
Now, also, you describe in the book a very interesting play between race and ethnicity and class. For example, the commercial elite is perceived as foreign in some way. And then there are issues of color and shade in the hierarchies of Haitian society.
Yes.
Could you talk about that play between race and class?
Yeah, well, this is something that has been traditionally used in Haitian politics. In other words, if you have the majority of Haitians are black, and there is a very small group which is light skin, obviously black, but in Haiti we. There is a demarcation, and we have an anthropologist has studied the matter. There's something like 27 different shades and different names to describe the colors that the Haitians may have. But the bottom line is that you have the mulatto classes on the one hand, which have traditionally been the most privileged groups in Haiti since independence, and then you have the vast majority of the population, which is extremely poor and which is black. The issue there is that you've had a political class of black entrepreneurs, if you want to call them that way, who views ethnicity to, in fact, to some extent, erase the question of class. In other words, the mulatto groups could always be presented as the exploiters, and to a large degree, this is what Duvalier did. François Duvalier, the father, presented the mulatto groups as being exploitative, which they were. But on the other hand, that allowed him to hide the fact that he was doing exactly the same thing and that he was promoting his own group into a position of privilege. There has been some play recently on the issue of color again because the demarcations have not changed significantly. In other words, the light skin are still those who have power, and they are clearly identifiable as such. And some black politicians have tried to manipulate the issue of color for their own advantages. And I wouldn't be surprised in the next elections that this is going to be another a significant issue that will be used by particular political parties in order to advance their particular interests.
And also, a lot of your book is addressed in part to the theories of democratization that have been floating around for the last couple of decades. We often see a formal democracy that doesn't really change the underlying structures of power in a society. And you also talk about how, in Haiti, civil society, a very fashionable term, often acts to accentuate the gaps in power between the powerful and the powerless. So what about this transition to democracy? How much during the 90s really changed in Haitian society? How much of this class structure that we were just talking about was challenged, and how much of it remained intact?
Well, I think initially, with the fall of Duvalier, there was a challenge to the basic class structure. And this is why you had so many coups or attempted coups, because the powers that be wanted to stop the process of challenging the class structure, and actually they did succeed ultimately. But the process of democratization itself, I think, has changed some elements of the situation, in particular cultural elements. And if you were growing up, for instance, in the privileged groups in Haiti in the 60s, you would have maids, and maids would be fired whenever the boss, as it were, would feel like he could or she could fire the maid. There was no real resistance in that sense. Now things have changed because, and this is one of the contributions of the Lavalas movement, when Aristide came to power, he had a slogan which simply said, Tout moun se moun, which is if you translate that from the Creole, it essentially means that a human being is a human being. Well, that very simple slogan was really revolutionary in the conditions of Haiti, because it meant that the very poor peasant could, in fact, be an individual, he could be a citizen. So there has been a change in the perceptions of people. On the other hand, the material realities and the class structure, well, those things have not changed. And if anything, they may now be in the process of being consolidated again. And in other words, we are, to some extent, going back to old conceptions of politics. Democracy, I think, is going to be a facade. You are going to have elections, what you might call electoralism, but the basic premises of society will not be challenged. In addition, given the dependence of Haiti, whatever government may come to power will have a very difficult time in terms of transforming the economic structures, because the dependency is such that we will probably have to deal with the IMF and the World Bank, structural adjustment programs, continued privatization, and those things, in my mind, can only aggravate the inequalities in a Haitian society and ultimately consolidate that very unequal class structure. Then you mentioned the issue of civil society, and as you know, civil society has been used as if this is a magical one that can generate democracy. And in my mind, civil society is much more complicated than that. To a large degree, civil society reflects the material realities, in other words, the questions of class power. So if you look at civil society in Haiti, it's really an affair of the privileged groups. There might be very progressive members of those privileged groups in civil society, but nonetheless, the overall nature of civil society in Haiti is really an institutional arena where traditionally privileged groups can, in fact, represent their interests. So civil society might ultimately reinforce the existing class structure, because most of the organizations of the poor and the peasants, well, they lack the resources, they lack the means, and they obviously lack the time to organize and to be viable groups in that civil society. So civil society tends, in my mind, to replicate the inequalities that exist in the larger society. So it's not some sort of magical instrument that is going to generate a liberal democracy, let alone a genuinely popular democracy.
I'm speaking with Robert Fetton, who is the author of Haiti's Predatory Republic and a professor of political science at the University of Virginia. Well, let's talk about Aristide's experience in and out of office. When he was in power in the early 90s, you say that there was not much in the way of organization that he could rely on. There was a lot of rhetoric and language, not too much in substantial organization behind him, right?
Yeah, what you had was a popular movement, masses of people, but no real coherent political parties or coherent political structure. And this is why it was called the Lavalas movement. It essentially, it does convey the idea of a flood of hundreds of thousands of people moving and wanting to change their existential conditions. But on the other hand, they lacked the structures. And Aristide himself never liked structures. He always talked about movement, about fluidity. And that was one of his major flaws, because he never created a real political party. There was never a real popular organization. And in fact, those organizations which started to crystallize were very quickly, to some extent, pushed aside, precisely because Aristide's vision of politics was, to a large degree, a messianic vision, that he was the symbol of the people, and the people identified with him, and he identified with the people, so you didn't need any structures to mediate that relationship. And that was pregnant with many problems, and the problems of, obviously, crystallized in his second coming when he came back in 1994, and then when he was reelected in 2000.
Yeah, let's. I mean, he was overthrown in about 91.
Yes, he was overthrown in September of 91. He was elected in December of 1990. Then he spent 7 months in power, and you may recall also there was an attempted coup immediately after his election that was in fact put down by the population, because the population took to the streets and prevented the coup from a fellow by the name of La Fontaine, who was one of the chief Makout under Duvalier.
And then he was restored in 94 with...
the help of the Marines, exactly.
Yes. So what was the interest of the United States in that restoration?
Well, this is a very interesting and intriguing question, because when you look at Haiti, I don't think there is any real strategic interest in, from the perspective of the United States, or any real... there are no real natural resources of any value. I mean, we do not have oil. We don't have uranium. We really have very little to offer except cheap labor. I think that the intervention in Haiti under Clinton responded to a few factors. On the one hand, as you may recall, there was the Somalia incident. And I think Haiti provided to the Clinton administration an opportunity to reassert American power and to say, well, we are still the hegemonic power in this new world system. It was a very cheap way of proving that the United States still had the capacity and the will to use military force. There was also an ideological component that I think played some role in the mind of Clinton, and that was the whole business about the spread of liberal democracy. So it was partly an issue that was salient in liberal ideology at the time. And finally, and I think more importantly, there was a real fear about boat people coming from Haiti to the shores of Florida. When Clinton was elected, and he was elected on a platform that criticized the Bush administration for returning Haitians to Haiti. Well, immediately after his election, he decided that that policy that he had opposed, well, it was actually the only policy that the United States could adopt. But there was a quid pro quo between Aristide and Clinton. Clinton promised Aristide that he would be restored to power if, in fact, Aristide signed an agreement saying that the United States had the right to return Haitians to Haiti. So the boat people, the fear of very poor Haitian getting to the shores of Florida, I think, was extremely important. And finally, you had domestic politics and the very significant role that the Black Caucus, Congressional Caucus, played in putting that issue on the agenda of the Clinton administration. But if you were to look at all of those elements, I think ultimately it was a matter of both people.
Once restored, he was Aristide was his hands were tied by the IMF, right? And that was part of the deal, that he was completely subservient to U.S. power at that point.
He had to. I mean, that was one. He signed an agreement before he was going to before he was restored to power by the Americans. That agreement said that structural adjustment programs, the IMF and the World Bank, would in fact become the key institutions in the Haitian economy. Now, Aristide resisted that when he came to power. Not that he resisted structural adjustment per se, but there was an attempt to mitigate the most extreme liberal elements of the structural adjustment program. But if you look at the economy now in Haiti, virtually everything has been privatized. Virtually all tariffs have been eliminated. And you have very few state companies that are still owned by the government. You essentially have the ports, and you have electricity, and you have also the phone company. On the other hand, it's very difficult to see how you can privatize electricity, because it's a company that is going to be always bankrupt insofar as poor people don't have the means to pay for electricity, and the electricity is stolen at an incredibly high rate. The port might be, in fact, some area where there could be privatization. But on the other hand, given the whole business about drugs, about the fear of terrorism, it may well be that this will no longer be on the agenda. And finally, you have the phone company. But on the other hand, the phone company, if it were to be nationalized, is really a very old and inefficient phone company. And the cellular phone business is already privatized. So there's very little in terms of privatization that Haiti can do. So it's virtually no longer anything left standing in the economy. So I'm not quite sure what structural adjustment is going to mean in Haiti. I don't see how you can lower wages further. So it's going to be a very interesting process to follow to see what kind of plan of recovery the major international institutions, financial institutions, are going to propose. Actually, it's not just a matter of proposition. What they will ask will be, in fact, policy. I don't see how any government at the moment in Haiti could deal equal to equal with the financial institutions.
And we've only got a few minutes left, so let's talk about the recent events. What do you think was responsible for the recent fall of Aristide? And was it domestic interests? Was the U.S. behind it, some combination of the two?
I think it's a combination of everything. By itself, the civil opposition would never have been able to overthrow Aristide. The opposition was able to overthrow Aristide, first, because you had that armed insurgency, and two, because the French and the Americans essentially abandoned Aristide. So it's a constellation of factors. Aristide probably would still be president if it had not been for the armed insurgency and the decision on the part of the French and the Americans that he was dispensable. And I think those are the key issues. I don't think the opposition, the one that existed in Port-au-Prince, on its own would have had the power and the capacity to force the issue.
And what about the role of the United States?
Well, the United States, if you recall, the United States recognized Aristide as the president, the legitimate elected president of the country. But the U.S. never liked him, in particular under the Bush administration. And once there was an opportunity to see him go, I think they decided that it was the best solution from the perspective of U.S. interests. You have to remember that the fellows who are in charge of the Latin American desk in the Bush administration are Roger Noriega and Otto Reich, and those are really extreme conservatives. Neoconservatives of a really virulent kind, and two fellows who never tolerated Aristide, and probably would have had their days earlier on if it had not been for Powell, who ultimately decided that Aristide was a legitimate president. But Powell changed his mind fairly quickly. I mean, a week before, the U.S. said that Aristide was dispensable, actually, that Aristide had to go. Powell was saying that this was not a possibility, that the U.S. was going to support the CARICOM agreement, whereby Aristide would stay in power and the opposition would share power with Aristide. But as we've seen, that changed fairly quickly. And I think the French were very instrumental in that transition. The French who have never been very significantly involved in Haiti, apart from cultural reasons because of the French language, well, I think they used Haiti as a means of patching up their relationship with the U.S. So Haiti provided an opportunity for the French to begin the process whereby Aristide was pushed away, and then the U.S. followed.
And finally, even given the constraints that Aristide was operating under and the many flaws of his regime, this looks decidedly like a turn for the worse. Is that right?
Can you repeat that?
I said despite the constraints that Aristide was operating under and the flaws of his personality and his the whole structure of governance, this what's happened is definitely a turn for the worse, right?
Yeah, my personal feeling is that the best solution would have been, in fact, a compromise. Because what you've had as a result of the fall of Aristide is a fairly short but intense period of looting and destruction of whatever was left of the economy. You had also now a government which is not really a legitimate government. You have no... We still don't know when we are going to have elections, what kind of elections, who is going to be able to participate. We also have the problem of the restoration, it looks like, of the army. And that, in my mind, would be a tragedy, because if you recreate the army in Haiti, an inordinate amount of resources is going to be spent on an institution that we do not need. And in addition, that institution has traditionally been a repressive institution, an institution... whose only role has been to repress the population. So that would be indeed very bad news, but it looks like the army might in fact be recreated, and then you'll have a police. So you're going to have a very repressive environment if the army is recreated.
All right, well, not good news, but thank you for joining us, Robert Fatton, who is the author of Haiti's Predatory Republic and author and also a professor of political science at the University of Virginia. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. I'll be here on recording next week and I think the week after as well. Till I'm sitting in this seat again in a few weeks, goodbye. Stay tuned for the news, and let's go out with a little more of Charles Ives' Unanswered Question performed by the Cleveland Orchestra.